Iambic Audiobooks and Grey Wolf Press present One Vacant Chair by Joe Coomer. Read by Leanne Howlett. Introduction by Sir Joshua Reynolds, Discourses on Art, from Discourse 8. Those painters who have best understood the art of producing a good effect have adopted one principle that seems perfectly conformable to reason, that a part may be sacrificed for the good of the whole. Thus, whether the masses consist of light or shadow, it is necessary that they should be compact and of a pleasing shape. To this end, some parts may be made darker and some lighter, and reflection stronger than nature would warrant. Paul Veronese took great liberties of this kind. It is said that being once asked why certain figures were painted in shade, as no cause was seen in the picture itself, he turned off the inquiry by answering, "Una nuvola che passa," a cloud is passing which has overshadowed them. Part 1. Still Life. Perhaps our lives are sustained by a suspense of dying. There are things I know and things I don't know, and everything else is in between. Grandma Hutton called Aunt Edna to her deathbed and then decided to linger for 22 years. She measured her life with spoons, the brimming spoons of medicine or milk or soup that my aunt balanced with a painter's sure grip over her own cupped palm, her free hand mimicking in form and movement the dull spoon's bowl, her arm the narrow handle. My grandmother, for the last few years of her life, answered the telephone as if she were standing at the mouth of a dark cave, hallooing for a lost soul. When someone answered, she was always taken aback. That's how we talked to her at last, by phone, everyone but Aunt Edna. Then the family returned to Fort Worth for the funeral like separate drops of condensing water pooling in the bowl of a cold spoon, a last offering to an old dead woman none of us cared for. That's not true. Aunt Edna missed her. We began by carrying the chairs out to the vacant lot next to the house. The old house was full of chairs, to the exclusion of almost all of the furniture. This was my Aunt Edna's collection. "It's one thing men are good for," she said, shooing them away from the saran-wrapped food. "Carrying chairs." She pulled a cane-seated, ladder-backed chair away from the kitchen table, thrust it into my husband's arms, and said, "Out to the vacant lot. Everybody pick up a chair. I want evenly spaced rows with the chairs facing west so Brother Roberts is looking into the sun." Then she looked at me. "Sarah, you help me with Mama's chair. We'll put it up front next to the preacher and put her in it." "You could leave it empty," my husband said. "It would be like one of those missing pilot formation flyovers." It bothered me that I still thought Sam was funny. Someone you didn't respect shouldn't be able to make you smile. Grandma's chair was overstuffed, rotund, a Depression-era lounge chair covered in pale green mohair. It was some work to get it out of the bedroom, through the hallway, and outside onto the porch, where we sat it back down to rest. "Mama loved this old thing," Aunt Edna said. "There's no good place to grab it," I huffed. "It's got good lines." "We should brush it off while it's outside. There's cat hair on the back side." It crossed Mama that her favorite chair was the cat's favorite chair, too. She'd hold her forearms up in the air after she sat down till I came and brushed the hair from the nap. I'd tell her the cat only sat in her chair because he loved her, but the cat and I knew that was a lie. "What happened to your cat, Aunt Edna?" "Oh, I gave him up, gave him to a friend. He was a good kitty, too. He always sat in the light, just like a model should." "Grandma made you give him up." "Well, she was sneezing, sort of between sniffing and sneezing. She didn't make me." "Was there ever any snot on her Kleenex, Aunt Edna?" "No, the Kleenex just comforted her. Me getting rid of the cat comforted her, too." "You can get that cat back now." "Oh, that cat's long dead. This hair here's the last of him." "Maybe we won't brush it off then," I said. Chairs moved past us in my family's arms, more than 20 chairs from the living room alone. Windsors, Empire, Colonial, Victorian, Edwardian, Arts and Crafts, Art Deco, chairs from every period, none alike, no pairs, much less a full set. The dining room table was surrounded by 8 chairs that were separated by 200 years in the making, not to mention the variety of style, seat covering, and finish. Whenever we sat down for a meal, everyone was at a different level, children likely to be as tall as their parents, full-grown men with their chins resting on their plates. There were chairs where end tables should have been, chairs where cabinets and hampers should have been, chairs sitting inside dark closets, chairs hanging upside down on the walls. The television sat on a chair, as well as the microwave, a room fan, and a fish bowl. They all left the house one by one and were set in rows in the St. Augustine grass, so that the vacant lot came to resemble an outdoor theater crossed with a yard sale. Aunt Edna and I sat Grandma's chair next to a tall oak stool that was reserved not for Brother Roberts to sit on, but to stand behind and rest his book on. "Should we have a pitcher of water for him?" I asked. "Well, I hope the sun in his eyes will keep him from talking too long, but if he bears up to it, he might need some water. I'll bring over a little chair to set the water on. Now, which of these chairs would accept a glass of water?" She turned to the growing audience of empty chairs, scanned them, and said, "You." 4 rows back, on the groom's side, was a white wicker corner chair, low, with a rather unstable seat. It took her a full minute to balance the glass on the uneven reeds. "Now," she said, "if he stops in the middle of his speech for a drink, he'll have to down it in one gulp. It will be too bothersome to set a half-full glass of water upright in this chair during a sermon. We don't want any of this talk a while. Take a sip, talk some more, have a sip business." "Are we in a hurry, Aunt Edna? Doesn't that wicker make the water seem cool and inviting? Don't stomp on the ground as you pass by." I followed her back into the house, which would now be her house, I supposed, and found it virtually empty. There were beds and dressers in the 2 bedrooms, and a table and sideboard in the dining room, but the remainder of the house seemed almost littered. Under the 12-foot ceilings, lying on the oak floors, was everything that had been held in the chairs. Books, clothing, toiletries, magazines, knick-knacks, dishes, photographs, and telephones. In my aunt's room, all her paints and brushes were shoved into a corner, and they in turn held pinned to the wall sheaves of watercolor papers and sketchbooks. Aunt Edna's favorite chair, a 1950s kitchen chair, chrome tubing supporting a thin red vinyl seat and back, was the only chair left in the house. No one was brave enough to remove the dozens of open medicine bottles stacked precariously on its seat. She swept them all into a box in one movement. The vinyl of the seat cushion had split like a ripe tomato left in the sun too long. The backrest sported a gray band-aid of duct tape, as if a tomato could be repaired. Once she carried her chair outside, the house was empty of chairs, and yet still full of them. Every chair we'd carried out was still there. Aunt Edna's chairs were simply her models. Every wall in the house was hung with sketches, watercolors, and paintings of chairs. Simple pencil studies of foliate carvings on knees or stenciled crest rails, watercolors of single chairs in a meadow or a parking lot, a flight of chairs winging through deep grass, an oil portrait of a stodgy banister back paired with a low, bow-backed Windsor that had to have been influenced by Grant Wood's American Gothic. She continued to paint since I'd left Fort Worth 26 years earlier, since everyone had left, and she was still painting chairs and only chairs. It seems odd now to write it down that she only painted chairs, but at the time no one in the family remarked upon it much. Aunt Edna liked to draw and paint chairs in the same way that my father liked to read books about the Civil War, or Aunt Margaret liked to play charades. I think it only seems eccentric now that her paintings have become important to people outside the family. Maybe we were wrong not to notice. The fact that her house was full of chairs was more interesting than it being full of chair paintings. The reviews use words like compulsive and addicted and driven, but we only knew she loved chairs. Caring for Grandma and her job at the elementary school seemed the biggest part of her life. These people who now care about her art look at all of us in a dumbfounded way when we can't provide more details about her life, about her passion. But we didn't return to Fort Worth often, after my parents and Aunt Margaret and her family, my cousins, my brother, after we all left home in the mid-70s, a year or two before Grandpa died. We'd return for an occasional holiday or stop by Refugio Street if we were driving through on a business trip. Aunt Edna was left behind to care for Grandma, and although we were fond of Edna, neither Dad nor Aunt Margaret could abide their mother, and so in refusing Grandma, we lost Aunt Edna in the bargain. I was like everyone else in the family. I visited Grandma only twice in the 20 years after I graduated from college. She threw a fistful of pill bottles and a clock at me the first time, and on my second visit 8 years later, she was asleep. I spoke with Aunt Edna for a couple of hours that visit, invited her up to our house in St. Louis, and continued on to Austin to a craft show. All the time I spent inside talking with Aunt Edna, I was worrying about the glue melting on my Christmas ornaments in the back of the station wagon, that I'd have nothing to show in Austin. So I have nothing left of that conversation but my worry of glue. But I do have the summer that was before us, the day of Grandma's funeral service. I lived with my spinster aunt that summer, back in the old house on Refugio, where I'd played as a child. We were two fat women, 18 years apart, a chair artist and a designer of Christmas ornaments, who only knew we had troubles and a hot summer to get through. I can tell you about that summer. I know that much. When Brother Roberts arrived, Aunt Edna led him into the kitchen and put a tall glass of water in his hand. His hand shook with Parkinson's and the lip of the glass rattled against his dentures. Grandma and Grandpa were members of his church till the day Grandpa died, and although Brother Roberts was retired, he still did services for members of his old congregation and $65. Nearing 90, his coal black toupee fit his head like a single sock drawing on a tin mailbox. My father and Aunt Margaret followed him into the kitchen and thanked him for coming. But all the kids cleared out of the house, afraid they were going to be baptized by Brother Robert's second glass of water. Aunt Edna was pushing the water on him. "God bless you," he said between sputtering gulps. "Awful warm this time of May," Aunt Edna said. "We missed you in church these last 20 years, Edna," he said. It was all I could do not to reach up and twist his toupee 90 degrees. The way it hung over his ears made my own itch. How could he stand someone else's hair in his ears? "Well, after Daddy died, Mama got sad," Aunt Edna said. Brother Robert spoke slowly and softly, almost biting down on each word to get it out. "She forgot that Jesus still loved her, but I missed your daddy, too. He was a good man." "Another glass of water, Brother Roberts?" Aunt Edna asked. "No, I'm full of fire, and I don't want to put it out. Are we ready to begin? I'd like everybody seated before we go out." He reached up and put a finger in his ear, pushing a tuft of toupee farther into the canal. I kid you not, everybody in the room put a finger in their own ear and twisted and scratched. It was as if we'd all heard something we couldn't believe, which isn't a good crowd reaction for a preacher. Brother Roberts had left his wife on the front porch. Daddy told me later he did this because the money was always paid inside the house, and Mrs. Roberts was known to refuse all payment if it occurred in her presence. "We won't profit on others' pain." So he'd left her on the porch, a tiny aged woman, surrounded by 8 or 9 kids from Manuel Wara Elementary who'd come to the funeral for Aunt Edna's sake. Sister Roberts was handing each of them a single peppermint, holding her mouth wide as she did so, signaling to them to eat. "Sweet little birds," she rasped, in a voice as dry and light as the pages of a Bible. Brother Roberts and his wife were a package deal. He sermoned and she sang. She wore a pink pillbox hat and matching short gloves. Her stockings hadn't shrunk as much as her calves had. Her hose were so twisted from knee to ankle that it seemed she was screwed into her shoes. There was a big crowd in the front yard. The family and guests stood in the grass and on the sidewalk, the men holding their hands over their crotches the way they do when they wear suits to funerals and weddings, the women with their fingers pressed to their lips as if they'd just been told the deceased died, the kids moving around like dogs and cats, sniffing their own and everyone else's unfamiliar facial expressions. I looked over at the vacant lot, already broiling in the morning sun, the shadows of Aunt Edna's chairs crawling and stumbling over one another, stretching out beyond the stool pulpit and climbing up into the two big pomegranate trees near the alley. With its rows of individual chairs, short and tall, plain and adorned, the vacant lot now looked like a 200-year-old cemetery, the varied tombstones of the inhabitants of a small town. Aunt Margaret, my father's older sister, waved the crowd toward the empty chairs as if she were conducting an orchestra, using both arms fluidly, her head snapping toward the vacant lot at each crescendo. She was 5 years older than my father, and another 5 years older than Aunt Edna, and 400 years older than everyone else on the planet now that Grandma was dead. She slipped behind the mass of the crowd, and using her two joined and cupped hands, gently scooped everyone toward the funeral. Both gestures were ones of control. She was an expert in the body language of authority. Tiny inflections of her pelvis, the capitulation of her chin, the affected drop of her eyelid were all designed to manipulate. She would never say she wanted her way, only pose for it. Any suggestion that Aunt Margaret pointed her cheek toward was doomed. Men buckled at the collapse of her thumb. If she gazed off into the distance, everyone in the room stopped speaking. To my great delight, this language was only human, and therefore dogs and cats treated her with the same benign intolerance they showed a couch they didn't like. I have seen 3 different animals pee on her ankle. Even then, she wouldn't utter, "Bad dog," but only intimate the animal should be executed with dull forks by responding to your apologies and questions with a protracted examination of her fingernails. Sam said the animals were just marking her to warn away others of their kind. He thought one of us should pee on her foot, too, and then her power would be destroyed. We in the family had worked out, over years of experience, a tactic to thwart Aunt Margaret's input, which was simply not to look at her. We avoided her gaze as if she were Medusa. If you wanted to suggest a restaurant for lunch, you spoke up and searched the faces of everyone concerned, blinked as you passed over Aunt Margaret, and then waited for a response. She wouldn't or couldn't verbalize a negative unless as a last resort. As long as you didn't glance at any part of her body, you could pass on, make progress. But if you didn't blink at the right time, or if she'd moved unexpectedly to another part of the room and you accidentally caught a view of her wilting toes or disappointed knees, or the complete lack of your personal worth in her eyes, then you might as well move on to the next suggestion, or better yet, simply ask Aunt Margaret what she'd like to do. I'll give this much to Grandma. If she didn't like somebody, she threw something hard at them. Aunt Margaret pushed up her hair and back, lowered one eyelid over half the pupil, and offered you her white throat while she implored God to commiserate with her. Most people would rather take a blow to the forehead with a clock. Now, as matriarch of the family, Margaret prodded us toward the empty chairs with gestures of resigned responsibility and careworn servitude, her hands falling like dead sparrows from the gold buttons on her bosom, from the emeralds in her ears. And although she acted as usher, Aunt Margaret was the first to sit down, taking a seat on the corner of the first row. Her husband, Alf, who was hard of hearing and prayed for blindness, sat next to her. Alf's chair was short, with splayed feet, while Margaret sat in a Chippendale easy chair with boldly swept wings and broad proportions. Daddy sat next to Alf in a caned Eastlake side chair, and my mother in an ice cream parlor bentwood that showed red paint through a crackling coat of yellow. I looked across the field of chairs for one of my own. Sam had taken a seat in a faux bamboo dresser chair and motioned for me to take the place next to him, but it was a steam-bent plywood school chair, and I'd sat in one of those long enough. It's where you sit down that determines everything in life. I never choose a seat casually anymore, even when the room is empty. In college, I sat down in a life drawing class next to a boy with the prettiest blue shirt. It was the first time either one of us had seen a completely naked adult woman. I turned out to be his second. I met my first serious boyfriend at a wedding reception, where there were no place cards. I sat between him and his mother, and they both pulled on me from opposite directions for the next 2 years. I took a chair next to my former boss at a crowded conference table, and he proceeded to run his claw along my inner thigh. I had to find a new job, but he had to find a hand surgeon. My first husband, of 1 year, got up out of a chair so I could sit in it, and he still thinks I owe him. How many times have I sat down next to someone to momentarily find they smell bad, or cough, or find the weave in my socks interesting? I try not to sit next to fat people because I'm fat. I try not to sit next to skinny people because they remind me I'm fat. Let's not even mention people who look desperate, chairs that share armrests or slatted benches. But the chairs at the funeral were filling quickly, so I took a gray metal folding chair 2 rows behind Sam. He frowned and turned away. Beyond the immediate family, I recognized 3 ladies from Grandma's Bridge Club, Mrs. Rodriguez and her husband from next door, and 2 women who worked with Aunt Edna in the school cafeteria. I wondered who was feeding the kiddies who hadn't come to the funeral. The children and teacher who'd brought them sat in the back row and looked for all the world as if they were waiting to begin a game of musical chairs. Mrs. Sanchez from across the street wore an impeccable black suit that must have been 30 years old. It looked like a copy of the outfit Jackie wore to the president's funeral. I could have invited some of my friends from high school, but never felt the urge. There were several people I didn't know, a Mexican family, 2 ladies that might have been from Grandma's once and long ago church, and a young boy who led an old blind man to a Boston rocker. Even the Mexicans turned as these 2 approached, the only blacks at the funeral. The neighborhood was all white when I was a child, but for the most part was now Hispanic, save a few old-timers who were waiting to die in their homes like Grandma. The old man said, "That's good, Billy. You picked me a good one. I'll be all right now." The boy squatted next to him in the grass. I don't know why I felt so uneasy watching him. It wasn't as if he were going to turn suddenly and catch me staring. Maybe it was because he couldn't. I actually wondered if he was at the right funeral. He could have used a shave. That's what I was thinking when my cousin Joanne tapped me on the shoulder and said, "That's Mr. Lawrence and his grandson. He canes chairs for Aunt Edna." "Why is he here?" "I think he's friends with Aunt Edna."
"How do you know that?"
"I've been here a couple times when he was working on a chair. It's an amazing thing to watch. Is this seat taken?"
"No," I said. "Make yourself comfortable."
Trapped, I thought. Joanne is a whisperer to whom all conversation is a sharing of secrets, of suspicions cast and conspiracies foretold. The only things she's sure about are the beneficial qualities of various roots, herbs, and quasi-vitamins when applied, ingested, or inhaled, and which she happens to sell.
"When were you here to meet a friend of Aunt Edna's?" I asked.
"Oh, I come through all the time." She said this as if she were admitting to pedophilia. "My main supplier is in Dallas." The people behind us leaned forward. "Aunt Edna is a ginseng nut. She uses more than I do. She can testify to its positive nail growth effects." I turned my head and looked away, pretending she was confiding to someone else.
"I can get you some for wholesale, Sarah. It will relax you, give you a tendency toward more complete fulfillment in everything you do. Have you ever had a ginseng orgasm?"
"What?" I said too loudly.
"It's a life-changing experience."
"Speak up, I can't hear you."
"I only have so much, Sarah," she whispered, turning and smiling at everyone around us. "Over a 3-day period, utilizing ginseng aromatherapy, 100 milliliter tablets taken orally 6 times a day, ginseng gel to the eyelids combined with a thrice daily ginseng douche."
"Shh," I whispered. She shoveled a hush right back into my ear.
"Nothing completely natural should be embarrassing. That's what I tell my children when they pass gas. Farting is a natural reaction to the wrong mix of herbs and amino acids. Did you know that vitamin B, taken in the right proportion to banana salts, can, with the application of topical oils, of course, effectively reduce your risk of breast cancer, not to mention making your nipples softer?"
"Here comes Aunt Edna with Grandma. For God's sake, Joanne, be quiet."
I've got Kleenex if you need it," she said for my ears alone.
Brother Roberts followed Aunt Edna from the house. She carried Grandma's ashes in a wooden box that she'd painted five small chairs on, one for each side panel and the lid. Each chair was in a different landscape of flowers, field or forest. Clouds scudded through blue skies. She sat the box in Grandma's chair and then looked for a seat of her own.
"Oh, they didn't leave her a place," Joanne whispered.
My parents and Joanne's hadn't saved a seat. There was a moment of hesitancy, of half-risings and reconsiderations, before Aunt Edna sat in the wicker chair next to Brother Roberts and held his water glass in her hands. As we waited for Brother Roberts to begin, all our attention focused on him. A quavering voice ruffled the air between the many chairs, a voice like thin corrugated tin. It rose and fell in shallow waves. It was a voice I'd lost so long ago that it didn't sound the way I remembered it. Sister Roberts was up on the porch, her eyes closed, her hands clasped, singing Roy Acuff's Great Speckled Bird. I'd given up church so long ago, lived away for so many years, that I'd forgotten Baptists sing with an unwary abandon, a flagrancy of love. Sister Roberts broke my heart and made me sorry for a few moments that my grandmother didn't love me, that she was already gone. I hoped Grandma was now in a place she wanted to be. My chair wavered under me, one leg sinking further into the sod. I felt grass itches working into my ankles and calves. Sister Roberts raised her arms to a revolving ceiling fan and an unseeable Jesus, and the wind blew the sparse strands of her untucked hairline flat and smoothed the loose skin of her forearms till it glistened and took her quavering voice to new levels of vibrato. It seemed that the very air was splitting, that room was being made for something to slip through. Joanne sobbed in a feathery way, and I saw my father's body bent, as if he were a hospital straw. I marveled at Sister Roberts' gifts, her ability to mollify grief by expressing it. When she finished, every chair in the vacant lot sighed under shifting weight. Old springs twanged and popped, cane and wicker cracked. The glued joints of splats and stretchers and spindles spoke a kind of brittle weariness, an appeal for humidity. A palpable dust of dissolving upholstery and dry leather, motes of human skin, and the hair of long-dead cat billowed into the air between the end of Sister's song and the beginning of Brother's prayer. This arid and infertile pollen, smelling of dry glue and fetid sweat, was somehow comforting, proof of a past, of lives lived, of moments of individual comfort spent sitting down, an old book or an old cat in your lap. But dust rising, dust falling, was a testament of some kind of change. Things had been stirred about. Brother Robert slammed his Bible down on the wooden stool with the report of a rifle, an act at which he seemed practiced. Yet he'd caught the tip of his pinky between the wood and the word and almost leaped into Aunt Enda's lap to disguise the pain. We'd all been gazing at Sister Roberts, suspended as she was between two porch posts like a deflated Greek goddess, when the Bible came down and brought us to attention. Not a chair squeaked. Birds changed direction in mid-flight. Aunt Edna held the glass of water at arm's length, afraid that Brother Roberts actually would sit on her. He wrapped his good hand around the afflicted one and shook them both like a pair of dice, while hopping on one foot around the Bible on its stool altar.
"He's hurt his finger," I whispered to Joanne. "No, it's the power in him. His love for the Lord can't be contained. He's always like this."
He stopped suddenly. The congregation swayed in their chairs for a better view, already acquiring some of his rhythm. Brother Robert spread his arms wide and raised his hands above his head and then proceeded to climb an unseen ladder.
"I can't get there this way, can I?" he asked.
"No, you can't," someone in the front row answered. He took his wallet out and offered money, gray-worn singles, to my father, Aunt Margaret, and to three other old ladies. No one took his bills.
"I can't buy a place in heaven, can I?"
"No, you can't," a woman yelled.
Individual hairs of Brother Robert's toupee lifted tentatively on the wind, like the legs on one side of a spider you've incompletely crushed. His coat was too long, his tie too short.
It was plain he hadn't bought a new suit since he'd retired 25 years earlier. He walked a figure eight, enclosing the stool and Aunt Edna, then walked a second, pivoting on the stool and Grandma's ashes. He squatted down and looked under the chairs.
"No matter how far I go, no matter how many places I seek, will I find heaven on earth?"
A pattern was developing here, and the congregation was catching on. 4 different adults and 7 of the 9 third graders answered, "No, you won't," in unison. The adults who'd so answered looked at one another with satisfaction. The kids giggled. Poor Aunt Edna sat hunched in her chair before us, as if she were being made an example of, a sinner brought up for judgment. She grimaced at each question and response.
"Who killed Elizabeth Hutton?"
Brother Roberts yelled. One of the school children shouted back,
"No, you can't."
"Jesus did it," Joanne whispered, and I reached over and slapped her wrist.
"Who took Elizabeth Hutton from us? Who murdered her body? Who stomped on her fleshy heart, ran over her thinking mind with a big truck?"
He looked at my father.
"Did you do it?"
Before Dad could answer, he turned to my aunts.
"Did you do it? Did you?"
They both seemed frozen, the fingers of their hands spread stiffly, as if they'd just dropped a half dozen china plates. Brother Roberts turned to all of us.
"Did any of you send her away? And if not, who came and got her? She's not here, is she? We all know that. This isn't her in this box, is it?"
"No, it isn't," someone answered.
"No, it isn't. Jesus demolished this body as he's ruining yours and mine. He's doing it on a daily basis, on a minute-by-minute basis. He'll kill us all in the name of his sweetness. Now I'll ask again, who murdered Elizabeth Hutton?"
"Jesus did,"
voices answered.
"And how do we get to heaven?"
"Loving Jesus," voices answered.
"Is that rational?"
Brother Robert screamed.
"No, it's not," he answered himself.
"No, it's not," he said again more softly.
"How do we get to be more like Jesus? We love a world we can't understand. We love a world we know we have to leave. Now, dear family, are you going to let go of your mother, of your grandmother, of your great-grandmother, as she let go of you? Are you going to bask in her memory and rejoice in her salvation? Elizabeth Hutton has gone on."
Here Brother Roberts inhabited a long pause, the way a tree inhabits bark. It seemed to suit him. He seemed comfortable, ageless, almost graceful in silence. No one answered his last questions. He looked across the assembly, held his arms out as if he were being crucified, and began to quiver. His Parkinson's shaking had returned. I could almost see the leaves falling from his limbs. The old blind black man said, "Amen." Brother Roberts answered, saying,
"Amen, thank you. Go in peace, Sister Elizabeth Hutton. We loved you while you were here. You've left us this fine family as a legacy. 3 children, 5 grandchildren, 9 great-grandchildren. We'll be all right. We'll carry on."
He was tired now, faltering. Even the Bible looked heavy in his hands. Aunt Edna held out her glass of water, leaned forward with her entire upper body toward him. I leaned forward, too, hoping he'd take the water. "It's too hard. Rest," I thought. "We won't leave." Instead, he dropped one arm and asked for some commiseration.
"It's hot here, isn't it?"
He flapped his Bible beneath his armpit.
"Yes, it is," the bridge ladies answered.
"It's a hot place to live a long life, Texas. I've never had to give a sermon on hell to my congregation. We live in Texas.
But look, here's a cool glass of water. This woman who's just lost her mother is offering it to me. She's taking care of me, isn't she?"
"Yes, she is."
"Her gesture is an affirmation, isn't it?"
"Amen." "Life goes on, doesn't it?"
"Yes, it does," solemn voices hailed.
"I'm going to have a sip of this cool water, and then I'm going to pass it on. I'm going to have a sip." And here he did so, the rim of the glass clattering on his teeth. "And I'm going to say yes. Each of you do the same. Think of Elizabeth Hutton.
Have a sip of cool water, saying yes, and pass it on." He handed the glass back to Aunt Edna. "We're not going to end this funeral saying no. We're going to join together and finish by saying yes. We're going to affirm loss and pain, affirm healing and joy, affirm a sip of cool water. I say yes. What do you say? Let's send Elizabeth Hutton home now. Say it with me. Yes."
Voices. My own voice, Joanne's whisper. Aunt Edna's lips were wet and trembling. I saw my mother hand my father a Kleenex, and all around me, soft and loud, brittle and startling, the single word passed back and forth. Brother Roberts, exhausted, sat on his stool at last, smoothed his toupee, smoothed the loose skin beneath his eyes. I looked to Sister Roberts. The small program the funeral home had printed for the service listed Amazing Grace as the closing hymn. She sat on the porch, her gloved hands clasped in her lap. I thought she'd forgotten where she was, that she'd missed her cue. But then from somewhere far away, undulating in the heat off the ground like a butterfly trying to gain altitude, came the aspiring strains of bagpipe music. It might have been harsh and dissonant close by, but as the piper was unseen and the music so distant, seeming as if it might fade away at any moment, we all felt we were on the verge of losing some beautiful thing. We wanted it to be closer. People turned their heads, looking up and down the street and finally up to the rooftops. The music existed only on the air, and breathing it made me weep.
"Who ordered that?"
Joanne whispered. I shook my head, running my finger under my nose. When the hymn ended, when we were sure it was gone, Brother Robert stood again and said, "The family would like to invite everyone inside the house for refreshments." Aunt Margaret stood up, and by the curve of her spine everyone understood she was to enter the house first, followed by not some but all present. I was on my way to escort Aunt Edna into the house, but Sam beat me to it. We think alike, Sam and I do. Part of our problem. We can rarely surprise each other. Wasn't it petty that I was aggravated because he took her arm? At the time, I sincerely knew that he'd done this to get under my skin. She was my helpless aunt, not his. Now I had to walk into the house alone. Once again, I'd confused a funeral for a wedding. I thought I should be helping her, and he hadn't given me the chance. Sam looked over his shoulder, found me, and I shot him a calculated display of bitterness that would have made Aunt Margaret proud. He simply turned back to her, without allowing me so much as a grimace of exasperation. I thought it cold-blooded. Aunt Margaret and Alf went inside, followed by Mom and Dad, Aunt Edna and Sam. By then, Brother Roberts had stationed himself at the door so things slowed down a bit. I shuffled along next to my little brother Mike and his wife Darcy. The pair of them never seemed to know anything, other than that their feet reached the ground. If you tell everyone in a room which restaurant we're all going to, they somehow miss it and have to ask halfway there. I've explained the same Thanksgiving cherry bean salad to Darcy at least 17 times. Mike to this day can't remember Sam's brother's name. I'll say, "Oh, John had a car wreck," and he'll look befuddled and ask, "Who's that?" "Sam's only brother," I'll say and shake my head. He'll grin at me and reach for the loose skin on the side of my knee. I love him, but he has to be led by the hand to the bathroom. As we stood there listening to Brother Roberts blessing the people who'd already thanked him, Mike asked me, "Where's the cemetery?" "I'll make a wild guess, Mikey, that it's the same one Grandpa's buried in." "Darcy and I didn't know Grandma was going to be cremated. We thought we'd get to see her one more time." "It was fine by me. If she still had arms, she'd be throwing things at us from the casket."
"She never threw anything at me," Darcy protested.
"You weren't one of the deserters," I explained. I stepped back to let the children pass by. The rows of chairs in the vacant lot were skewed now, disorderly. Individual chairs seemed ostracized, others offended. It was as if they had nothing in common anymore, other than a general attitude toward the West. Then I noticed that Grandma's box, Grandma, was still sitting in her chair. we'd left her behind again. End of part 1.